The Science of Safety Online, brought to you by the Online Safety Exchange. I'm Martin Cocker, and this is Radio SOSA. All right, Ellis Hunsberger, I wanted to get you on Radio SOSO because it's clear that you're somebody that cares really deeply about trust and safety and online safety. You know, you've got a Trust and Tech podcast. You are producing a newsletter on a regular basis. There's information, it seems like almost on a daily basis, on LinkedIn, helping out other people and pointing people to things on LinkedIn there. And I guess the first question is, why? Why are you doing all of those things? Why are you so interested in doing that?
That's a really good first question. Firstly, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. Why? I think because I started in trust and safety 20 years ago. I founded an online forum. It was just like a silly little niche message board with a couple thousand people. I'd never heard of trust and safety. Social media wasn't a thing. But when you have online spaces, people can be toxic and horrible to each other. And I failed completely. Like, I failed that community. I did not know what I was doing. I was terrible at enforcing policies. I was terrible at writing policies. I swore I would never do it again. And then I ended up a few years later working for a dating app and being a moderator and, you know, figured out how to actually do it professionally and not just as a hobby. And back then we had no conferences. There are no podcasts like yours. There's nobody talking about these things on LinkedIn. And I had to figure out a lot on my own. And so over the last few years, I've sort of, as I've become more confident in myself and my career and sort of talked to a few different people, I realized that like I do have things that I could share that could be helpful for other people. And I don't want anybody else to feel how I did back then, which was like alone and without advice and community around me. So I don't think I pretend that I know all of the answers, but I hope that by talking and speaking out, I inspire other people to do the same thing, and then collectively we can all help each other out.
Well, I think that you're definitely inspiring people and making people feel helped out based on what I've seen online. I totally hear what you're saying about not feeling like you know all the answers, but still wanting to share what you've learned. I think that's what we're seeing the online safety community or trust and safety community sort of mature into a community that kind of sees it that way, to get away from the idea that, you know, somebody might have all the solutions, or keeping stuff to yourself actually benefits you in the long term. You know, the idea that sharing actually works better. What you said a silly little forum. I really want to circle back on that in just a minute. Sure. It's really interesting in your sort of career progression, because the first thing that's listed on LinkedIn, I hope you don't mind me saying this to people who aren't connected with you on LinkedIn, but is like a production manager, a production assistant on Dave Chappelle's Block Party. So you obviously didn't leave university thinking, I'm going to go into the tech industry and you know, work in trust and safety. Is that forum that you ran that kind of pivot point, or did something else happen that sort of moved you away from television and that into the tech area?
Yeah, what a good question. There's a bit of through line with my career, but it takes some explaining. So I started college thinking that I wanted to do political science or economics, something to help save the world and make it better. And then I realized that actually I didn't like thinking about those things all day and doing it every day, and I would get burned out very quickly. I took a film class just as an elective and fell in love with it. And so I got a degree in communications and was focusing on film and video, specifically editing and post-production, and moved to New York City and worked in editing houses and worked for some pretty cool companies. I worked for MTV and for Vice News when they were doing some like very cool documentaries. So I edited documentaries about war and, you know, all sorts of like actual, you know, journalistic things, which is great. But then in 2008, 2009, there was a recession and nobody was making documentary films anymore. And the hours in the film industry were really tough. I didn't like freelancing. A lot of the jobs were freelance where you just work for a few months, then the film ends and you have to find something else. And that freaked me out. So I was in the process of figuring out how else to save the world. If it's not going to be political science, it's not going to be making documentaries. I was like, what else am I going to do? I don't know. You know, I was 25, just trying to figure out how to pivot. And a friend of mine is actually a founder of OkCupid, which was a dating app that I worked at for a decade. And so he knew about the previous work that I'd done with his online forum, and he knew that I had some experience with moderating and trust and safety. And he was like, hey, we need somebody. The company was 20 people at the time. And so I was a frontline content moderator, just saying yes, no to scam accounts. And it was supposed to be a silly little part-time job while I figured out what else I was doing with my life. But I found it so fascinating. I loved working in tech. I loved working at a startup and just kept raising my hand and saying, hey, what else can I do? What else can I do? And I grew as that company grew. So it was a very lucky opportunity for me. But finally found my place. Now, you know, 15 years later, still doing work in the same sort of way.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about the time, because you spend quite a lot of time now working in trust and safety and dating services. But just before we get onto that, I just want to just mention the silly little community you mentioned before called Viva La Vinyl. Is that still running? I know it's not your thing now, but is it still, can people go find it if they wanted to?
No, it doesn't exist anymore. It lasted for quite a while, but
I would have thought it'd be even more popular now because records are making, you know, this sort of comeback and there's this community for them.
I know. If I was older and knew what I was doing more, I could have done something cool with it, because it was basically Discogs before Discogs was a thing, or right around the same time that Discogs was starting. So it was like listing all the different vinyl versions of records and different pressings and letting people trade records. It was very, very cool.
I will get onto proper trust and safety stuff in a minute, I promise. But if you do you have a big vinyl collection? Are you one of those people that, you know, has quite a significant collection themselves? Which by modern standards, probably more than 5 records, I suppose. Do you have a collection of vinyl?
Not anymore. I used to. I used to have a lot. But after I moved a few times, I realized that I was just moving them and not really listening to them. And so I gave them to my friend who ran a record store, and he got them to new homes where they would be appreciated more.
Rehome them. They sound like little, puppies.
That's what it felt like.
So I'm getting, it's a long, very long winded way of getting to this question, but when you had that full vinyl collection and people came around and you really wanted to impress them that you were a music aficionado, what record would you have put on so they would have said, oh yes, Alice knows a bit of stuff about music?
That's a really good question. I think it depends who it was. I mean, basically all of the records were punk and hardcore and a very obscure subset of, like, you know, punk records that people only listen to. Like, you go to a show in a basement and there are only 100 records. So probably I would have pulled out like one of the test pressings that were like, you know, only a couple made, but not any bands that anybody would have heard of.
Test pressings. I didn't even know they were a thing.
Yeah.
All right. Probably the first question, just to shape this up, and in some ways you've almost had this experience, but if you just tomorrow, you know, one of your friends comes to you, like I say, you've almost had this experience already. One of your friends comes to you and says, you know, we're having this, we've built this platform, a social media sort of platform, we're connecting people, and it's very, very successful. And we've just realized that we don't really have any kind of trust and safety components. And we, you know, we need you to hit the ground running. Could you come in and just, you know, just get some safety up and running, make stuff safer? Where do you start? If you go into a business, you know, the business is already running, it's doing quite a lot. Where do you start? Where are you thinking as you arrive?
Well, I would look at all of the different risk profiles that exist. So what are the ways that people can communicate with each other? What are the kinds of media that they can upload? What are the, like, what's the reason for the platform? Is it a marketplace where people sell things? Is it a dating app where people meet each other? Like, that sort of informs it. And then I would take a look at what are the most severe, awful, terrible things that can happen that are probably going to be very rare? And what are the very common things that happen all the time? And that usually, like, both of those two extremes tend to be the ones that you get put the most attention on first. And then look at user complaints. Like, what are people noticing? What are they writing to the customer support team and complaining about? What is, like, the most visible harms that make people not want to use the platform anymore, and sort of build some kind of priority there? And then look at, like, what's feasible, you know, like, how many people do you have? What are your resources? What's your timeline? What's your budget? And, you know, when I started working at Grindr, I basically went through that whole process and, you know, made a list of, like, lots and lots of things that I wanted to do, and just slowly worked my way through it.
Yeah. We'll definitely come on to Grindr in a minute, because Grindr is a fascinating business, and therefore it has, and it has a particular kind of almost role within the ecosystem of dating apps. But just before we do, you mentioned there about doing what's feasible. You said we got to do what's feasible. I mean, it brings me to this question, which is, you've been inside trust and safety, inside tech doing trust and safety for a long time, and you will have engaged with a lot of people who are outside, so people like myself who work in NGOs or you know, regulators. What are the things what are the top things that people like myself or regulators might not understand about doing trust and safety inside a tech company that then leads to the kind of difficulties in terms of engagement between the different sectors? Sorry, I appreciate that's a really big question, but if we just kind of stick to the top few things.
I think ultimately what it comes down to is, there can be a mismatch in expectations between what is actually preventable, especially when you're talking about high severity situations. These are, like, criminal acts, you know, and criminals are going to be criminals. If a platform shuts them down, then often they go somewhere else. Harms, like, for a dating app, for example, if two people meet up and one person wants to harm the other, that scenario happens from people who meet at church, or people who meet at a bar, or people who meet in school, as well as people who meet in dating apps. And so sometimes people think that the level of data available on platforms will, like, predict who is going to be a criminal. And platforms don't have crystal balls. Like, they can look at some user behavior, but until somebody does something, especially if it's an in-person harm, there's, you know, not a lot of way to know. And there's, you know, background checks, that's a possibility, but then background checks don't necessarily capture everybody who's going to be violent. And so you can apply that to, like, any number of types of harm. But I think that, yeah, just sometimes the expectations are, like, tech companies should be able to solve a lot more when there are societal problems that we haven't figured out. Like, as a less severe example, racism. You know, like, we as a society have not solved racism. Therefore, platforms are also not going to be able to solve racism. Like, it's not going to be possible to figure out the exact way to moderate that kind of content without making somebody mad.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think I spend quite a lot of time trying to articulate a particular thing about trust and safety and online safety. That is, the job of trust and safety and online safety is to help individuals navigate the challenges that actually exist, not to try to solve those challenges for society. Of course, a lot of people who work in online safety, a lot of us have very strong feelings about what would make a better society. We would certainly like to see those things advance, but those problems have to be solved everywhere, not on a platform. And so I do see people saying often, you know, the expectations that are put on platforms are higher than the expectations that generally exist in society for resolving some of those things. So I hear what you're saying there. And I had another point which seemed salient as it came into my mind but dropped out. So maybe it'll come back later.
I have another one too. I think, you know, the other tension, not just between what is actually possible and preventable and, you know, what's just reactive, is when you talk about trust and safety and what's feasible for platforms, there's this big tension between safety and privacy, and also safety and self-expression. And the more that people are able to express themselves, the more engagement there is on the platform. That's often like a big driver, like a big metric at platforms, is to have more engagement. There's also a lot of people who are very pushing privacy, very privacy forward, and privacy is safety for a lot of people. So that's also very important. And there's all of these privacy regulations and people who say, for example, that encryption keeps people safer because you won't have government spying on you and everything you say, or, you know, for other various reasons. But then when you have encrypted platforms, or you have everybody saying anything that they want and, you know, you can't monitor it, then that's not great for safety sometimes. And so, you know, that's the other big thing, that a lot of folks tend to have a pet idea, like advocates outside of platforms who are interested in online safety. They'll be like the child safety person who doesn't want anything encrypted, or they'll be the privacy person who wants everything encrypted, or they'll be the free speech person who wants everyone to say everything. And none of them want to compromise with the other. And platforms have to compromise on all three. Like you have to have a little bit of give and take in all of those areas to balance them properly and to have a good user experience. And so that's another thing that I think people don't talk about enough when it comes to safety.
Yes, because people tend to have each of those debates individually. You know, should we do more to protect children? Yes. Should we do more for privacy? Yes. Not realizing those things may come into conflict. The point that I had that dropped out of my mind was that a lot of people outside of tech see what tech can do in terms of matching advertising, in terms of putting data together for the benefit of the business profitability, and they assume that those same tools, therefore, and that same capability could be turned to trust and safety. And that's why I think that often they think, you know, well, you should be able to predict who's going to commit an offence, because you can predict who wants to know if they're buying, you know, and see an advert for a bike or something. So aren't those capabilities the same? I mean, isn't that the same thing? Why can't they?
You're actually asking.
Yes, because I feel like, I mean, you know, people say that, so I want to ask. I mean, I have my own view on why they're not, but I'm interested to know yours.
I mean, we would live in a world like Minority Report, where you're arresting people for pre-crimes, and that's fundamentally terrifying to me.
Yeah, well, it didn't work particularly well in Minority Report, and that, you know, that I totally see where you're going in terms of the predicting. Do you think that, and you know, you can't speak for the whole industry, and you know, obviously there's a difference between the capabilities of a, you know, highly established business like Google or Microsoft or something, and then one establishing tomorrow. But do you think that there is, you know, a lot of energy put into sort of developing algorithms for improving that kind of customer experience and things, and opportunities are missed to turn that technology to trust and safety?
I mean, we're definitely at the beginning of a new era, I think, as far as trust and safety tech goes. Like the number of startups that we've seen in the last few years that have come up in this space are super encouraging. I think one thing that has always been difficult is, you know, until relatively recently, a lot of platforms developed their own bespoke in-house trust and safety tools. And so nothing's off the shelf. Like there's no expert in trust and safety tools. It's like Google does their own thing, you know, tiny little startups do their own thing. Everybody develops it separately. And, you know, that's pretty time consuming. And so I think we're definitely starting to enter an era where there are companies where the entire thing, like everything they do, is trust and safety tech and trust and safety tooling. And as we get more competition and some of these companies become more established, we'll start to see some like very cool innovations that then potentially could be available to everyone. So I think that plus, you know, the promise of generative AI and some of the things that can do, hopefully we'll start to see more and more available in the next few years. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, if I stop going off on tangents, we might actually get to talk about generative AI in a minute. But you're currently working at Partner Hero, which is business process outsourcing kind of thing for trust mm-hmm. and safety, is it? So we'll talk about things that happen at Grindr and issues relevant to dating apps. But so currently, you've sort of taken all that expertise, and now if people employ Partner Hero, and I'm just going to simplify this for the non-tech industry people out there. You know, they employ Partner Hero to outsource trust and safety functions too. Is that correct, or is it bigger than trust and safety?
Yeah, Partner Hero has been around for 10 years. Primarily, historically, they've done a lot of customer support and customer experience, and that's where a lot of expertise lies. But over the years, they've had a whole variety of customers say, hey, you're doing a really good job at customer support. Can you also help us with this moderation issue? Or can you also help us with community management? Or can you also be the trust and safety response team checking moderation appeals? And it's just sort of been this scope creep over the years because they've been trusted by partners. And so I worked with Partner Hero. They were the BPO that Grindr uses. And so I worked with them for several years. On the other side of things, they were the vendor and I was on the platform side. And I was starting to look around for a new job and trying to think about what I wanted to do next. I'd been in the dating industry for 14 years almost and knew that I wanted to work broadly across the industry instead of like super deep in the dating app world. And so I was thinking about vendors. And so they brought me on to help develop and expand the trust and safety offering that Partner Hero has. So I'm taking a good thing and making it better.
So let's talk about your time at Grindr. So you came from OkCupid, and I had to read on OkCupid. I'm not sure if OkCupid operates in New Zealand, but it turns out I haven't been in the need for a dating app for a while. So it says on OkCupid that you can choose from 60 different gender identities and sexual orientations. So clearly OkCupid, served anybody, everybody.
Yep.
But Grindr it's so associated with gay dating, right? So is there something when you're working in an organization that has such a significant role in an area where there is, such a variety of views in society about, whether it's okay to be gay and whether gay people should marry and all those issues that are going on. And then you're in this tech company that's connecting people, does that make the experience significantly different from, say, what you were doing at OkCupid? Are there differences, or am I overthinking it?
Yes and no. So, yeah, I mean, certainly all the companies that I've worked for, I think it's sort of a mandatory requirement if I'm going to work somewhere that I want to know that it's going to be LGBT friendly, and OkCupid definitely was. And there's a... the LGBTQ community is a unique community and has unique needs. And the way that people need safety, especially, I think, different. So, for example, on Grindr, before I started working there, they created a set of unique app icons that look like a calculator or a clock or a notebook, like really generic icons, because Grindr, as you said, is so associated with the LGBTQ community. And for some people, it's not safe for them to have the Grindr app on their phone. If somebody sees the app on their phone, they'll be kicked out from their family. They'll be fired from their job. They'll be arrested in some places where being gay is criminalized. And so it's crazy and very unique, I think, for companies like Grindr. Fundamentally, the name of the company is a safety issue, let alone anything that's actually happening inside of the app. So that's something that is definitely unique and, wouldn't be the case at a more mainstream app.
Before generative AI was the thing everybody was talking about, we were talking about augmented reality and virtual reality and Apple released their product and obviously Meta's investing in it. Do you think there's a real opportunity in terms of AR and VR for improving dating app experiences and creating, safer experiences? Is that a thing? do you think?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think a lot of dating apps have been experimenting with video, and that's definitely been popular with quite a few because people like to have a kind of vibe check with somebody before they potentially meet in person. So a phone call or a video call is good. I think, yeah, I mean, it's possible, I suppose, to have like an augmented reality meeting with somebody and kind of break the ice and have games and things that you can play. But then on the other hand, if you're not totally dating virtually, if you're planning on meeting up with somebody physically one day, part of the deal is like, are you who I think you are? Like, do you look like the person that I'm expecting to meet? Are you, you know, looking at me in a weird, creepy way? Like, are, you know, the vibe check, I think a lot of it is people's faces and expressions and talking for a lot of people, probably not for everyone. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there's opportunity there, but maybe it, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a perfect solution. I don't know.
Well, there's, I had to look it up. There's a, there is somebody that, that claims to be the first. They're called Flirtual. Flirtual is their name. And so they're a virtual dating app. So I guess we'll see how successful they are. And it does appear that they, you know, it's a virtual reality dating app. So you create an avatar. And so I guess that does create that, it doesn't answer that key problem, which is authenticity. Are you the person you claim to be? And that's clearly going to be something, if you're going to be successful dating, you probably want to get off to that start. I mean, that's that with dating is dating apps is the, you know, is this particular kind of challenge that is that people are going to use your service to connect with another person, and then at some point they are going to physically meet that, or probably, hopefully for them, they're going to physically meet that person, fall in love and get married. But on that way, on the way, there is that physical connection or coming together, which you have facilitated as a business. I mean, is that, you know, 90% of your worry in trust and safety in a dating app, or is there a whole lot more that you have to stress about?
It's rare. So it's one of those circumstances that tragically can happen, but is not common. There's many more things like bots that are very common and also take up a lot of space and time. And so, you know, I think it sort of goes back to what I was talking about earlier, which is that you have to balance those rare but high severity instances with the more common but less severe. And yeah, on a dating app, you know, even things like romance scammers, which obviously defrauding somebody of their entire life savings is awful. But now there's also sextortion, which is, you know, a concern, and people are really feeling like their lives are destroyed from that. And so there's a variety of things in dating.
Yeah. And I guess what I've just stumbled on myself clumsily is exactly one of those issues that online safety is facing generally, which is that often the more common issues are not the thing that people are focused on. People are focused on those rare but high severity incidents. And when we're talking to people, we're not connecting with them about their real experience, because we're talking to them about things that very seldom happen and kind of glossing over the things that they're seeing every day and experiencing every day. And so that's something that I think online safety generally is grappling with. It's actually pretty easy to make, and I can make it now, an argument that catching rideshare is safer than catching a taxi. Because all the data that gets captured in the rideshare system, and so if anything happens, all that data is available, and you know that therefore makes rideshare the safest way to get from A to B. So it's probably a counter argument to that, but I'll just leave that as it is. But do you think that the safest way to meet people is through because of all of that information that's captured in the system? The safest way to meet someone is through an online dating app.
I don't know that I would want to make a claim either way, because people's use cases are so different and dating apps are so different. And, you know, it's certainly true that, you know, if somebody behaves badly on a dating app and they get reported, they'll get banned. Like all dating apps, all the major ones, all take victims' reports seriously and don't require, you know, a police report or anything else. They just say like, okay, we believe you, we'll ban this person. Can't necessarily say the same of other ways that you might meet somebody. And so, you know, in that way, sure. And also technology is, again, like not solving all of the problems that society has. So I don't know.
I wouldn't say sat on the fence or hedged your bets, but I think that was a very sensible answer. I
tried to be diplomatic there.
diplomatic. That's the word I was looking for. So let's just pivot a little bit. Let's just talk about, it's the year of elections. We've got all these elections going on around the world. Do you think that at the end of this year, we're going to look back and say somebody is in power because of AI or disinformation? You know, are we going to say that disinformation and AI was so impactful in one of these elections around the world that it put someone in power that wouldn't otherwise have been?
Probably. I think it also depends on, you know, disinformation isn't new. Elections, like, we've had sketchy political ads for decades where
you certainly have. Yeah, the U.S. certainly the US, has.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, where, you know, a quote is taken out of context, a photo is taken out of context, doesn't even need to be edited or Photoshopped necessarily. So that's something that isn't new. I think what's new is ability to create false images, for sure. The weird ways in which people get their news. So people aren't necessarily watching, like in the United States, like presidential debates. Some people who are running to be the person on the ticket for the Republican Party, like, didn't even show up to the debates. So, you know, it's like the ways in which we as a society have had these sort of gut checks of, like, who are these people? Do I trust them? Do I like them? Do I think that they have a reasonable argument for the reasonable question that a moderator asked both people? Those things are all being thrown out the window at the same time. And so I think the combination of more disinformation, more consumption from, you know, non-traditional journalistic sources, and people just generally not being trained with skepticism and not having great media literacy skills is compounding. So yeah, I think there'll be not surprise elections, but like elections that would not have happened a few years ago.
Just in terms of deepfakes, you talked about people being skeptical, and, you know, we're already seeing deepfakes that are, and certainly with photographed images, we've seen them for quite a long time, but they are, to the naked eye, to us looking, they're real. And so increasingly deepfakes are going to become more real and more convincing and more difficult to detect. Do you think there's a future where we just can't detect or differentiate a deepfake from a legitimate video? And then secondly, how are we going to ensure safety and trust in systems if that's the case?
So yes, I think that we'll get to a point where technology improves and it's difficult for people to tell, you know, pretty, like, we're already seeing hands with five fingers, not seven now, and it's only been 6 months or something. So it's definitely going to get to that point. I kind of wonder, you know, I think there's two realities. One is where people get duped a lot, and so they think that something's real because it's so convincing. The other reality is that nobody believes anything because it's so easy to fake everything that video and audio are no longer the reliable sources of truth that we've relied on for the last, you know, 50, 60 years. And it becomes like print, where you can type out easily anybody saying anything doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. And so then you rely on journalists and the integrity of whatever source it is that you're reading to, like, actually accurately quote somebody in text. And so probably it'll become like that, where if it's coming from a sketchy source, then no one believes it. And we'll just have to do the same thing that we do with text verification. But I don't know, all the newspapers are crumbling which is, like, not a good combination, is it?
It's, like, a good point.
Journalism more than ever, please.
Yeah, it's a good point that media has taken a hammering as a business over the last few years, but we may be desperate for independent media shortly, and expert commentary and trusted sources again.
Exactly.
in that near future. You have been subjected to, you've worked for companies that have been subjected to quite a lot of regulation. Can you think of any regulation which was applied to you where you thought, I don't particularly like it, but it's a really good piece of regulation? It's kind of forcing me into a space to or forcing my organization, my company, into a space where we're investing more in online safety and trust and safety. I mean, has regulation like that yet existed?
I'm not going to talk about specifics with companies that I've worked for. However, you know, I think that regulation, the goal of regulation, which is to know what companies are doing, to have them apply a minimum standard to support the safety of people, those are all the exact same goals that trust and safety leaders have. So we're on the same side. Like, trust and safety leaders, almost everybody who I know who's been a leader at platforms in trust and safety at one point or another has had to fight really, really hard for budget and resources because leadership often doesn't understand the importance, or maybe they don't care. Sometimes they do understand and they do care, and that's wonderful. But sometimes it, you know, does have to come from outside pressure. And especially when then it's a level playing field and all companies are being expected to have the same set of minimum standards or adhere to the same thing, then, that's a good way to kind of raise the bar across the board. So I would say generally, broadly, regulation can be incredibly helpful in that way.
Yeah, but you personally, you know, talking about OkCupid and Grindr, for example, you know, you're probably out in front of the pack a little bit. It sounds like, you know, there were organizations that were investing in trust and safety. And so when you talk about lifting the bar, and you can no comment this, plead the fifth on it, but do you feel like during that time there was regulation that made you do something, or do you feel like the regulation actually didn't quite get the threshold up to where you were already at?
I think it's fair for me to say, because this is public, one example would be transparency reports. Yep. So Grindr and OkCupid have never put out a public transparency report. That's just a public fact that's out there. And, you know, regulation is requiring companies to put out safety transparency reports. So, like, that's a fundamental change.
Which should lead to better safety outcomes.
I would hope so. I think like transparency reports are good in a few ways. One is, hopefully, and I'm not speaking specifically for companies that I've worked for here, just broadly again. I thought like a lawyer for enough years that I can put it in there. Broadly, if you have to put something out there for everybody to see, then it's good incentive to do better. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, you know, it's always been really difficult for trust and safety leaders to know what benchmarks even are. So, you know, we're often not allowed to share specifics with other companies. There's NDAs and everything's private. And so you can have background off the record conversations with your friends at similar platforms and kind of say, like, wasn't coming from me, but, you know, generally this range of things is what seems normal to me. But that is, like, you can't bring that to a leadership team and say, hey, X company is really doing amazing over here, and this is like what they're able to achieve, and we could do that with an investment, because none of it's public. So transparency reports are also good, just allowing the industry as a whole to benchmark and to start to set standards and to look and see what each other is doing. And hopefully that'll be helpful as well.
You mentioned people being on the same page, and you mentioned X company, but you weren't talking about X company, but I am going to talk about X company just for a minute and being on the same page, because in our corner of the world, out of Australia, the eSafety Commissioner made a decision that they wanted a particular video to be unavailable in Australia. Now, we could put aside the debate about whether that was the right decision or not. That's their decision. That's Australia's regulator that's made that call. So they make that call. X says, yes, okay, we accept that that's your call. They geo-block it in Australia. So on X, that video is blocked if you're showing an Australian IP address. But then the eSafety Commissioner and the Australian government, on behalf of the Australian government, comes back and says, that's not good enough because people can VPN past it. And X responds by saying, well, you know, you're not the regulator for the world kind of thing. We've got other. And I believe that actually today, as we record this, there's going to be a statement from coming out of the legal system in Australia, a position on it, coming out of the high courts. We're going to be talking, and whenever we producers can be in hindsight. So we probably don't know how to predict who's going to win, because that's a question for the lawyers. But just on that particular thing, you know, you've got a regulator in one country saying we don't want it on the internet, and you've got it's a multinational saying, well, you know, we've got other regulators. I mean, other than asking you whose side are you on or anything like that, how do you see that playing out? What do you think of that debate? Like, just this is a vague question, but just kind of, what do you think of
What's
that?
What's my take?
What's your take? Yeah. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. What's your take on that?
So, I mean, generally, I really am a big fan of the eSafety Commissioner. The work they're doing over there is very cool, and definitely trying to kind of lead the charge, and often coming from a very similar philosophical alignment to myself. I think the thing that I worry about with this particular situation is setting a precedent for one government to take something off the entire internet. Coming from Grindr, like, immediately the thing that I think about is LGBTQ rights. There's countries where being gay is criminalized. It's illegal to be gay. You can be arrested and put in jail. And so what if countries start saying, well, it's not good enough that gay content isn't allowed in our country. We don't want it anywhere on the internet. And look, there's a precedent for certain things being taken down by other governments. And if you listen to Australia, why can't you listen to us? Then platforms are put in the really difficult position of saying, okay, we're going to comply with one regulatory body, but not another. And, you know, it gets very tricky. So, like, when takedown requests are for a good reason, then it seems like an easy decision. But you always have to think about the flip side of, like, what would a terrible, corrupt, awful government do with that exact same power? And do you want to give that to them?
Yes. I mean, no, I don't want to give them that power. Yes, I agree with your answer. I suppose one other possibility is that if governments find that their regulators are conflicting with each other, it might force government regulators to start to align what they're doing. So, I mean, you know, your view that the tech industry can't really kind of deal with everybody wanting something different, and that's true. But one of the other pressures, I guess, is it might push people to align. Although, you know, realistically, you talk about the issue you just mentioned, you know, governments are going to be so far apart, it's hard to see how they would come together to meet a common standard that would be of any value. Well, we shall see how it plays out, I guess. And you know, maybe next time we talk, whenever that is in the future, we can have a look at what the rulings were and what they mean for everybody. But speaking of that, like, just, you know, you work in big trust and safety. These organizations are often based in America. America's been the sort of lead producer of these huge global tech-based companies. How much do you think that the trust and safety teams within the tech industry, and it's a kind of broad kind of in the tech industry within the US, really understands the trust and safety pressures in the rest of the world?
I mean, I think it's really going to vary on the size of the company. And so very large companies will have more global employees and more ability to have the person who's paying attention to what's happening in Australia and New Zealand, and the person who's able to, you know, think about other regions that are more specific. At small companies, I would say, you know, very little. It's definitely US-centric. And I think there's a real opportunity for the trust and safety industry to become more global and to be able to treat different regions equally as far as, like, cultural understanding, language coverage, you know, readiness in terms of election integrity and other things. I think there's an enormous amount of work that could and should be done to level the playing field there.
Yeah. And there are these huge markets that are really coming online, like India, that are quite different culturally and in many ways from the US, which sort of forces people to work out how to be successful in those markets, which I guess will bring some of that information to the front, to the top.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of a philosophical question there that I think that every platform has to answer for themselves. And I don't know that there's necessarily one right answer. There are several, but are platforms exporting a progressive Silicon Valley US-based worldview, and that anybody who comes to the platform then is saying, you know, LGBTQ rights are great, women's rights are great, this is the line for hate speech that we generally all agree on, and they're on that platform because of that shared set of values? Or is a platform going to say, well, we're not going to export our US-centric point of view, we're going to have more localized policies and more localized understanding of what the culture is in each particular market, but then it's essentially running a separate set of rules and enforcement, and some of them are going to clash with the, you know, views of the CEO, for example. Like, if you want to do business in a country that is, you know, oppressing women, and that's like culturally normal, then you have to make a decision about whether you're going to relax rules a little bit or say, okay, this is a line that we're drawing and we don't care that it's culturally acceptable in your country. Like, we're still going to enforce on our views of what hate speech is, for example. So it's, yeah, you can't do both at the same time. And I think every platform does it a little bit differently. But at the minimum, you should be aware of the different standards and make an informed and principled decision and just like say, this is what we're doing. This is why.
Yeah. And that's a fantastic answer and philosophical guide, I guess, or guide for people. It's a fantastic guide for people to end this podcast with. So I want to say thank you very much, Alice, for being on with us today. And I just wanted to leave with, I think I know the answer to this, but if you were the CEO of a massive company and you were faced with that choice of sticking to the US values or adjusting to local norms, where would you come down?
I very much would not want to be everything to everyone. I would want to create a corner of the internet where people are blind about, you know, the balance between free speech and, in my opinion, too much free speech, allowing absolutely everything, makes it unsafe for people to be there. So yeah, I'm on team progressive values.
Brilliant. All right. Thank you.